The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. There are 7 books in the series, and they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. I had William Matthews, better known as Willie Matthews, here today. He came down to do a podcast, and I've been wanting him to come on for a long time. He lives out of Denver. He's a painter of the West who's really known for his cowboy imagery, though he does so much more. In fact, he's got a big show going on right now in Denver that'll be up through February called Steel, which is really interesting on the steel industry, and a lot of his paintings are painted on pieces of steel. Now, I had these preconceived ideas of what I would get with William, and it wasn't what I thought. I mean, he grew up in San Francisco during the Summer of Love, had long hair, you know, was rebellious. And if you know him and what he looks like now or how you think you might know him, you wouldn't have guessed that. So this is a ride that was really took me to a new direction. And it's one of those podcasts where you think you're going to be there for an hour. And well, guess what, folks? It turned into a 2-hour program. So we're going to have a part one and part two of William Matthews. This is part one. I have William Matthews on the podcast today, and you look like one of your paintings, actually. I'm sure people have said that before, right?
Well, I paint what I know.
Well, I'm a huge fan of your work, always have been. I don't represent you, but, you know, the world needs to know more about you. Those that don't know, I think in a lot of places you're very well known, like in Denver where you live and you have your own gallery, right? You have your own gallery, too,
I do,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually always enjoyed having my own business. And I've taken a certain amount of criticism for it in the past.
By whom?
Oh, dealers, artists. Yeah. Some collectors, some people who think that it's not dignified.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That I should actually have my own business. But I like having my own business. I like, you know, there's a lot of galleries, and not, I'm not talking about your gallery, but there's a lot of galleries where you walk in and people are on their iPhone, or they're on the phone, or they're doing something, and they're kind of can't really be bothered. Or
right.
They're not articulate, or they're not dressed well, or there's something about it that bugs me. And so I've always really enjoyed having my own business, mm-hmm. where I could control everything. I could control the lighting, the walls, the atmosphere, and also, obviously, the people who work for me.
So, and do you show other artists?
I do occasionally, mm-hmm. but generally mostly me. And most people come in because they want me, but I do show other artists. Yeah,
yeah, I would think it would. I mean, it seems like it would be a natural.
I mean, a lot of other artists want, you know, a lot of other artists already have representation, and there are very few people whose work that I love who would want to be in my space, but I do enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And it has to
really
fit,
like,
right,
people.
Too. I mean, that's
absolutely.
The other thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's in the Rhino District, is that where it is?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just kind of, it's close to Lodo down in Denver.
It is, and I was in Lodo for many, many years. I mean, I've actually had a studio in that area of Denver since 1972.
Wow.
I had a design studio in 1972 where I was doing, I had just moved from L.A. and I was doing album covers, and I was kind of doing graphic design work, but then I was also painting. I did my first show in Denver in Larimer Square for Dana Crawford mm-hmm. in 1973. And I'd never done a show of paintings before in my life.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, we just started Larimer Square. We have this great space. Do you want to do a one-man show? And I said, I guess I do.
Uh-huh.
But I had been, you know, in L.A. doing all these album covers, so I'd been doing hand lettering and I'd doing been doing ideas and graphic things. And so I started doing paintings that had words in them. And some of them were kind of fake advertisements, and some of them were just sort of poetry. And it was really interesting. I mean, I was 23. I really didn't know what I want, how I wanted to position myself.
Yeah, you didn't know your artistic voice, probably.
As a painter.
Yeah.
You know, I did, I've been painting since I was a little kid, but I hadn't.
And I want to go back to that painting to a little kid.
Yeah.
Because I want to kind of get the basis of where you
come
from.
How it all started.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting to see the evolution of an artist.
Yeah.
And there's a theme that seems to run through a lot of the podcasts I do that enlightens me, and I think sometimes enlightens the artists themselves. But where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in New York City, lived there for about 6 months. We moved to Darien, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And then in the 50s, we moved across the country to San Francisco. My father had been in the war and had been in the Pacific Fleet and had had been sailing in and out of San Francisco for 4 or 5 years. And he swore to himself, if I ever get the opportunity, I'm going to move to San Francisco. So when
he was a Navy guy?
He was a Navy guy.
Yeah,
you know, Lieutenant Commander.
Hey.
And he loved ships and he loved the water. And so we got a house up on the top of the hill and we could see all the ships coming in. It was incredible. I mean, you know, there's the Golden Gate and there's Treasure Island and, you know, and he would keep he would keep track of every ship that was coming in, whether they were, you know, cruises or whether it was the Pacific Fleet.
Mm.
And it was, you know, so I grew up loving the Navy.
And you grew up in San Francisco.
I grew up right in the city.
Yeah. So you must, did you know about Maynard Dixon at that time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew about Maynard Dixon. I would go down to Maxwell Gallery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you
when
go.
When I was a little kid. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Maxwell Gallery?
I've had probably 30 or 40 drawings with his sticker on the back.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
And he had all of the great California artists.
Uh-huh.
And he had, you know, Arthur Matthews, and he had, you know, building all the way up through people like Raymond Staprins, and he, you know, Wayne Thiebaud, and all of those California guys. And so that was an education. It was just an incredible.
And where was he located?
He was on Sutter Street.
It was on Sutter Street.
And it was right next to my dentist.
Uh-huh.
So when I'd go down to the dentist, I'd always go to the Maxwell Gallery. And I got to know Mark.
Uh-huh.
Mark Maxwell and his wife. You know, he couldn't really care less about me, especially when I was a little kid.
Yeah, how old were you when you were doing this?
It's like 12.
Oh, yeah, you're young.
I was really young.
Yeah.
And his wife, but his wife was very friendly. So she would show me stuff and like take things off the wall and show me the back. And
do you remember any of those paintings specifically? Of course, Dixon that he might have had at that time. I mean, it's hard to remember when you're 12, but sometimes they
Dixon
do stick.
Dixon paintings. Oh, God. Dixon has been such a major river through my life that it's hard to remember where I first saw particular paintings. They also showed me people like William Russell Flint.
I don't know who that is.
He is a great watercolorist who was the head of the the Royal Watercolor Society, RWS. But he had an amazing ability with washes and figures, and he just mesmerized me.
Mm. And you saw that at his gallery?
I saw that. The first William Russell Flints I saw were at the Maxwell Gallery.
Oh, that's interesting. And so, but you were even, it sounds like maybe as a kid, like 6, 7, 8,
I was
you were
painting early.
Painting?
I was painting.
Wow.
I was painting in watercolor early. So my mother was a painter, and my mother was, you know, she'd gone to the Art Students League in New York and, you know, had always painted. And when we were in Darien, Connecticut, she was doing portraits of kids in the neighborhood and doing them for families. And so I remember, you know, painting. I remember seeing paintings and the smell of turpentine and brushes and palettes and, you know, all of that. But watercolor was always what interested me. It was never the buttery quality of oil paint never got under my skin the way. And she showed me great watercolorists. So we would go to museums a lot. My grandfather lived in New York.
He was an artist too, wasn't he?
He was an artist and he ran an ad agency. Mm-hmm. His name was Abbott Kimball. And he lived right across the street from the Plaza Hotel.
That's a nice
and
place.
Looked out on that great Augustus St. Gaudens statue.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an ad agency in the Seagram building on Fifth Avenue. And it was an incredibly elegant dynamic guy who traveled all over the world, and he carried his little Minox camera, and he'd do drawings, and he'd send us pencil sketches of people that he was sitting next to on the bus or people that he saw in the market. And he would send us stacks of these drawings.
Wow.
And it was so interesting because later on I realized, you know, this is exactly what I ended up doing for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And
still have those drawings?
You know, I don't.
Yeah.
My mother, they just kind of floated around. I do have a lot of his photographs.
Yeah.
And his photographs were really beautiful. And I have them, and they're mounted, and they're, you know, I mean, he really was an amazingly aesthetic, artistic guy.
And he encouraged your mother to be an artist?
He encouraged my mother to be an artist. And he actually gave me my first camera.
Mm.
And when I was 11, he came out to San Francisco for Christmas. And I found his original notebook that said what he was giving everybody for Christmas. And for me, I was the eldest, and it said Billy camera. And I remember when I got it, and it was one of those brownie cameras with a big flash, and I used it. I took a lot of pictures, and that was kind of the beginning of my love of photography.
Yeah, did you think you might become a photographer at that point when you're young?
Well, I mean, I am a photographer. You know, everything is kind of blended together.
I see.
And, you know, I mean, I thought when I was a kid I was going to be an architect.
Mm.
And, you know, and I am in some ways an architect. I mean, I always have architectural projects that I'm working on.
Yeah, you just did a big major one, right?
Well, that was a big commission on a great building in coordination with architects.
Yeah, cool.
But I'm actually working on renovating a great
cool.
house right now.
And you do that in Denver?
We do that and wherever we are.
Oh, wherever you can find the right home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just found a great place.
Yeah, you want to share?
Not really.
Okay, I understand. You can tell me later.
Yeah.
And so, but you're the oldest of...
I'm the eldest of four.
Four, and siblings are also interested. One's a landscape painter, right?
My sister Kim Matthews Wheaton is a beautiful landscape painter.
Yeah, I've got to look up her stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
She really is amazing. And my sister Carrie Matthews Knoll is an interior decorator and also amazingly aesthetic. And my brother, my youngest brother Peter Matthews, is an architect
and lives
in Manhattan. Yeah.
Yeah, and your landscape artist sister, where does she show?
She lives up near Portland, Oregon. She's been showing in Seattle and Portland, and I'm not sure exactly where else she's showing.
Yeah, we'll just give her a shout out in case people are listening so they can go look up her work as well.
She's so great.
Which I'm going to do as well.
We did a show for her down in my gallery in Denver.
Oh, yeah.
And about maybe a year and a half ago, and big paintings, she sold 25 paintings.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I sold none.
And does she work in oil?
She works in oil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be hard, I think, to follow you in watercolor, right?
No.
Your
everybody kind of paints in watercolor, but everybody does whatever they do separately.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody really feels competitive.
You never had that talk like, I'm the watercolorist.
Not at all.
I can see it.
I actually encourage them all to paint, whatever I can do.
Yeah.
You know. And how everybody had good, kind of goes off in their own
and
direction.
Where does she go in the schematic of age for your...
She's 16 months younger than me.
Okay, so you guys
so
are...
She's,
the,
she and I were raised really together.
I see.
Yeah.
And so you're raised in San Francisco.
Well, raised in San Francisco, and then we also had a house down in Carmel.
Mm, nice.
And so we were down in Carmel a lot, and we turned... My dad turned the garage into a studio for my mom. Mm. So we were down there a lot and, you know, got to know a lot of the local artists down there. And, you know, she showed in the Carmel Art Association. And
do her paintings come on the market occasionally?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know kind of how much. Her name is Joan Matthews.
Yeah, I'll have to look.
Or Joan Kimball Matthews. And I don't know... what a secondary market is. You know, she had shows in San Francisco down on Union Street, and a lot of the people that bought them were people that we knew in San Francisco. So a lot of times people will call me when they, you know, if somebody dies and they want to sell them, and usually I'll get them.
Add them to your collection.
And add them to our little stash.
And so did you live part-time in Carmel, or was this more a summer gig, or was it a...
Yeah, well, a lot of times in the summer, we go down on the weekends a lot. By the way, of all of us, my mother remains the best painter.
Very good.
Honestly.
She's still with us?
She is.
Yeah.
She's 96.
Good for her.
I wish she was painting now, because she really isn't.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting, because she... was a very sort of realistic portrait painter, and then we moved out to San Francisco, and she came under the influence of David Park and Richard Diebenkorn and a lot of those guys in the Bay Area, and all of a sudden she became this incredible abstract painter.
Oh, that's interesting.
But still with figures, an incredible sense of color, an incredible sense of design. And she just intuitively changed, and she was turning her paintings upside down and back and forth, and painting with sticks and with rags.
Did she know Oliveira at all, Nathan Oliveira? Do you know?
I don't know if she knew him, but you know, we all certainly knew his work, and we were all kind of around in that time. Kim, my sister, studied with Diebenkorn.
Oh wow!
And Carrie was over at CCAC, and I don't know exactly who she came under.
And so when you're in high school, are you painting as a way to actually start to make income at all?
I was painting early on. For me, it was a way to disappear.
Mm.
Early on, I recognized that I liked time off and didn't necessarily want to hang out with everybody.
So you consider
for better or for worse.
You're an introvert then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of myself as an introvert.
Yeah, I think of myself as well.
Yeah. So
that's why we're in this little room by ourselves.
Exactly.
The rest of the people, they can listen, but it's just you and me.
Yeah.
And so you were spending it time to create for
so
you.
So I would go off, and I remember so well going off and just sitting with my little pad of watercolor paper and painting wherever I was. Mm. You know, no matter where I was. And so early on, that was part of my, and I'd go off and paint with my mother, and she was painting landscapes. And that was something that we just did.
Mm. It was who you were.
It was who we were.
And so you
But
always...
early on, my mother took me to a show of landscape, of watercolorists, mm-hmm. where I saw... John Singer Sargent and Winslow Homer and
I love his stuff.
Andrew Wyeth and Demuth and Birchfield and amazing American watercolorists, and from then on I never wavered.
And when you're doing these watercolors, so right along you knew you were going to probably be a watercolorist. Is that true?
I remember deciding when I was about 12 that I was going to be a really good watercolorist.
Yeah, that's unusual.
I had no idea what that meant, or I certainly never thought of it as a career, but I remember thinking to myself, I want to get really good at doing that.
Was that after that show that you had seen?
That was after that show.
And do you remember where that show was?
It seems to me that it was at the De Young.
Yeah.
But I can't remember exactly.
But you vividly remember the
show.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And so in high school, did your teachers recognize that you had talent in this area? I assume they must have.
I was a total fuck up in high school.
A lot
and,
of us were.
And I went from school to school. And, you know, and the only things that I was really interested in high school were art and music, playing guitar and painting. And I don't remember getting a lot of encouragement from anybody.
Mm. Other than your own parents?
Never.
Your mom didn't give you encouragement?
Never.
Really?
Never.
Why do you think that is?
I think she really worried I was going to be an artist.
Huh?
And I think she really worried that I would never, the life of being an artist really had no good end.
Yeah, it was a tough, for sure.
Well, I mean, and you, and most of us, you know, really became artists really as a sort of process of elimination.
Yeah, I think
you
that's
know,
true.
Most of us just weren't capable of doing much else.
Yeah, I don't know if, yeah, I mean, I almost put it in the aspect that.
I don't mean to be sort of negative about
no.
it. But I mean, the reality was we weren't really cut out for the business world.
Yeah.
And we weren't really cut out.
Except you're an exception.
Well, I like business because I have done business. So I actually, well, we can get into that, but I actually ran a graphic design studio for a long time.
Yeah,
I liked that.
Yeah, it's clearly that you're good at business because you can't run a gallery and make it function unless you're good at business.
That's right.
But to get back to that, I think that a lot of artists, they're good at it. Everyone tells them this isn't an occupation you should do. You need to find something else. They
That's
look,
right.
they search,
right.
and they keep coming back to
That's
really
right.
what they're good at.
That's right.
Including you, it sounds like.
Well, that's right. I mean, I was told I needed to finish high school.
Yeah.
I needed to go to college.
Yeah.
I needed to get a business degree. I needed to, you know, and then I could paint on the side.
Yeah.
And the reality was I couldn't do any of that stuff. You know, none of it interested me. I mean, I was a hippie in San Francisco in the 60s.
Yeah.
And it didn't interest me, you know, going to school.
Yeah, and when did you graduate high school?
Assuming
you
didn't.
Okay, when would you should have graduated?
I would have graduated in the 68.
Yeah, because so you were 67, Summer of Love. Were you involved
exactly.
in that? Were you down there?
Was I involved?
Yeah, come on, baby.
Deeply involved.
Oh, yeah, I want to hear about this part. Yeah, so what the heck
well,
is that like?
San Francisco in the 60s was absolutely magic.
Yeah, you're 16 probably, right? In 67?
16, I was 17.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I went out to, you know, I was still trying to figure out what I was, yeah, listen, I had grown up in the 60s. So from 1960 on, we were surrounded with long-haired beatniks, and my mother was an artist, so we knew a lot of those people. And it was interesting. I mean, they were always interesting. It wasn't it wasn't sloppy. It was smart. It was perceptive. These were interesting, confident, articulate people.
Sure.
You know, when you look around now and you'll see people who are long-haired and they're stoned and they're sort of, you know, incoherent, that was not the way it was.
At least that's how you saw it as a 17-year-old.
No, I mean, really,
I was
aware of how things were.
Right.
And it was a very, very interesting time. People were really aware that this was a magical moment. The art was interesting. The music was interesting.
It was transformative,
there were ideas,
no doubt about
there
it.
Were, people were aware that they were sort of building a world that was new, that was different than what they had been told to do.
So are you at Haight-Ashbury in 67?
I was around there a lot, yeah.
And what was that like
at that time? It was a combination of things. I mean, you know, we smoked a lot of pot and you know, tried different substances.
Right.
And you know, that's part of what we did. I mean, I'm certainly can't divulge a lot of that over this yeah. interview, but let's just say it was very experimental in a wonderful and positive yes. way. And also, I was not a self-destructive kind of guy.
Yes.
So I wasn't really one of those people who was going to go over the edge, but I did, you know, everything.
Yeah, you were there in
I
the
was
thick
there
of it.
In it, and I was really interested in, you know, as Baba Ram Dass, the recently deceased Baba Ram Dass said, be here now.
Yeah.
And I was there then.
Experience it. And were you more interested in music at that moment? Because it was really, this thread of music was just
music
running
through. Music
was great. Through.
Yeah. But the art was great. I loved the posters. And, you know, I mean, there were incredible poster artists. And so I got into posters. I mean, I started doing a lot of that.
At that time frame?
Yeah. And then in 1970... In 1970, we all went out to Altamont.
You know, oh, wow. You were at Altamont?
I was at Altamont.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to hear about
tripping.
That. Oh, my.
And
yeah.
And it was a trend. That was a transformative moment. That was the end of 1969. That was 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's when the Stones...
The Stones played a lot free concert in yeah. Altamont Park in... east of San Francisco.
And they had the bikers there.
And the Hells Angels were the security.
Right, which ended up killing somebody, right?
Well, a number of people yeah. were killed. In fact, one guy was stabbed in front of the stage.
Yeah,
but there
right.
were other people that were killed.
Yeah, what was that?
But
you
were terrible. It was a terrible
event. Did you realize what was... I mean,
completely. I hated it. Yeah, it was terrible. But it was a very... It was... I mean, I remember vividly, you know, it was dry California hillsides... And with tall grass, and people were starting bonfires, these giant bonfires that were 20, right. 30 feet in the air, and there was no water. And I remember telling, you know, coming up to some guy who was lighting a bonfire, you know, with stuff that they had, and saying, hey, man, this probably isn't a great idea. There's no way to put it out. You know, and he said, hey, man, leave me alone. I'll, you know, it's free world. I'll do what I want.
Yeah.
And I kind of realized, okay, well, that's kind of that's a sort of symbolic moment of what today is,
yeah.
is everybody was kind of in it for themselves and nobody was, you know, really there to be cooperative, which is a big part of what the Haight-Ashbury world was, is what are we going to do as a community
right.
to make it better for everyone?
Yeah, that's right.
And Altamont was the exact
opposite. Yeah, and that came on the heels of Woodstock. Did you go to Woodstock?
I didn't go to Woodstock.
Did you consider going to Woodstock?
I thought about going to Woodstock, but I was really not drawn to go all the way back east to see a lot of bands that I'd already seen.
And it was all there.
A lot.
Yeah.
And we had a great scene going where we were, and there wasn't a huge incentive. If I'd been in the East, I probably would have gone.
So after Altamont, did that change the way you saw things somewhat?
And I didn't realize this at the time, but I remember going back, and I literally cut my hair off. I had really long hair, as I'm assuming you probably did.
Yeah, it was pretty long.
And you know, and I cut my hair off, and I decided I'm out. It was a great symbolic end of a bookend to that period of the mm-hmm. 60s. And I said, okay, I'm ready for the next chapter. And I decided that I was going to pursue trying to do album covers. And so I gathered all my stuff, which, you know, fit in about six boxes. And I got somebody to drive me down to L.A. I had no money and I had no contacts and I had really... no portfolio. I had spent 1 year at the San Francisco Art Institute, which was kind of a disaster.
What year was that? 69?
68, 69.
And is that how, because Vietnam's going on at that time
yeah.
too, because how did you avoid that?
Well, I got a, my number was 142.
Oh yeah, right in the middle.
So I was kind of in the middle and it was a dangerous moment. So I actually went over and went through the physical. And was pretty wasted, and but it turned out that my eyes were bad, so I got
4F.
I got a 4F. Yeah, so which kind of took me out of the running for
a while. Did you have discussions with your father about this whole thing? You must have.
Well, my father and I weren't talking.
Yeah.
For a lot of those years, my father was, you know, I was a huge disappointment to my father.
Yeah.
And he didn't really want, I mean, he had kind of written me off. He didn't really think that there was any future for me, you know, and, you know, he was really focusing on the other kids who he assumed were probably going to do great.
Yeah. But not Willie. Long hair, hippie. He just doesn't want to go, Vietnam protester. Yeah.
He assumed I'd be living under bridges.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was the reality.
So you didn't talk to him about what was involved?
Well, we did.
A little bit.
You know, it was sort of, you know, I'd say what I thought, he'd say what he thought.
Yeah.
You know, and never the twix shall meet. I mean, you know, we didn't really have constructive conversation at all.
Yeah. What did he think about the 4F? Did he say anything?
No. And I tell you, it was interesting. I mean, you know, there was a part of me that had always wanted to be in the Navy.
Sure.
And
your
there
dad
was
because
dad did it, but also I loved ships and mm-hmm. I loved everything about it. And so the fact that Vietnam was such a despicable conflict was a real bummer. I mean, it was really a drag that I was not going to get the opportunity to follow that.
Right.
Because that was something that I'd really had wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I wasn't going to go in and, you know, in that circumstance.
Yeah. Well, so you avoided that, which was, you know, fortunate for the art world for sure.
Well.
And you probably.
It was certainly fortunate for me.
Yeah. Because, it changed a lot of people, did a lot. I mean, that time period in that war seemed to be instrumentally transformative for your generation.
What's interesting is that my generation changed on a dime. So I was born in 1948, but for guys who were born in 1947, and in some cases even 1948, they went and they were not of exactly the same generation. My generation smoked pot, and we were a very different world. We had a different high school class.
Mm.
When I look back on the guys who were 2-3 years younger or older than I was, completely different view on the world.
Mm. What do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't know if it was the progress of the war and sort of what we watched on television and, you know, whether we were more vulnerable to it or whatever it was.
It could be music, too. The music changed dramatically, and that, along with media changing.
Any number of, I don't honestly know, but I've heard this from a bunch of other guys, and I have a lot of friends who are older than I. And, you know, it's interesting when you see exactly what year they were born, you can almost predict what their attitude was.
And 48 was this
kind of a different time.
Yeah. And you should have graduated high school in like 68. Yeah. So that's Tet Offensive, a big deal. Yeah. A lot of changes.
Right. Right.
So in 71, you go down to L.A.?
So 70, I moved down to L.A.
With no money.
Nothing.
No prospects, but you're going to...
Nothing. I don't need...
To do what? Rock and roll posters?
I didn't have a car. I'm walking in L.A., walking with this huge 40-pound portfolio that I have full of kind of matted drawings and, you know, linoleum cut prints and sort of watercolor doodles. And, you know, it was kind of laughable. I was living in a basement room up on Hollywood Boulevard over near Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Yeah, I know
with
that
one tiny little window up at the top. And it was an interesting moment. And I slowly started, you know, I'd started to meet art directors and I started to meet people who were involved in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, so then I got a little bit of work, a little bit of lettering, because I really didn't know anything. I didn't know how to set type and I didn't know, you know, how headlines, could be drawn out. So I just started hand lettering, and I figured out ways of doing hand lettering, inking, and I got really good at it. And so I started getting lettering jobs, and eventually I got an apartment above a garage off Santa Monica Boulevard, surrounded by porn theaters, which was its own bizarre neighborhood.
I'm sure, ecosystem,
And eventually I met Al Schmidt and Tommy LaPuma over at Blue Thumb Records, and they said, well, we're doing an album, a live album with a band called Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks. And I said, oh, shit, they're an old San Francisco band. I've met Dan Hicks. And they said, yeah, you want to do the cover? And I said, yeah.
Yeah, man.
You bet. So I did this cover, and we went down, and we recorded a live album at the Troubadour, which is about a mile from where I was living.
This is like 72?
This is 70.
Still 70. Okay, yeah. So this is early.
Yeah.
Linda Ronstadt's there by now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in and out, the Crosby, Stills, and Nash guys and all those guys.
Because that was the place, right? The Troubadour was there.
Troubadour was where all the music was, and it was great. Anyway, so I did this album cover, and, for an album called Where's the Money? And that kind of started off, and, eventually I was getting more work, and I eventually started working at Capitol Records doing... doing kind of whatever needed to get done. And I would, I'd ask the art directors, how do you do this? How do you do that? And guys started showing me.
And so did you do more album covers?
I did.
Yeah. What other bands?
Well, I did a bunch of other, second.
That's fine.
Start drinking water.
It's Arizona. We got to drink our water.
It is Arizona. Yeah. I started kind of getting more into country areas. I did a cover for Leo Kottke called Greenhouse. That was the first time one of my watercolors had ever been reproduced. Mm. And met Michael Murphy, and we did, he was a writer at Screen Gems. He'd never recorded anything at that point. But he had written this two-record set that Kenny Rogers in the first edition were recording. So,
and that was with Larry Kansler at that
and
time?
And Larry was involved in that, exactly, great Larry Kansler.
Who we've done a podcast on, for those who want to listen to it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, where we talked about you as well.
Oh, good.
So you meet Larry and you guys.
And Murphy.
And Michael Murphy.
And a lot of other people, the Warner, that was a Warner Brothers album. But, everything kind of ran together. I mean, there were a lot of interesting musicians around, and there were a lot of interesting projects, and I was being used for different bits and pieces. And, in fact, my son, who has a record store up in Denver called Recollect Vinyl Record Store, keeps finding album covers or pieces of album covers that I've done. Uh-huh. For Christmas this year, he gave me four things. I said, God, I don't remember this.
Huh. And so at that point, were you just doing illustration on record covers and not painting your
correct.
Own stuff?
Well, I was painting, but I was really trying to solve problems. People had records. Some of them had ideas. Some of them didn't have any idea. Some of them knew exactly what they wanted to do.
You were the art director in a lot of ways.
I was the art director, but I was also the photographer, and I was also the illustrator, and I was the lettering guy, and I was kind of doing everything. I was thinking that I could do everything well.
Did you think that was going to be maybe what you were going to do as a profession?
I didn't know.
You're still
I wasn't
young, right?
that far. I was a kid.
Yeah, you're in your mid-20s.
I mean, it was interesting to me at that point. But I started to get really burned out living in LA. I wasn't making really any money, and I was living in what I thought were pretty bad conditions. And LA was really smoky and smoggy in those days.
Yeah,
and
really
I'd moved down from San Francisco, which was the most beautiful city.
And Carmel, too.
And Carmel. But we loved you know, the city. We had a huge pride of living in San Francisco, and the idea of moving down to L.A. Right. was so such a downer.
Antithetical to what you would do.
Yeah.
I think most L.A. people and San Francisco people feel that way still, probably.
Well, at that time, anyway, L.A. now, by the way, is a much cleaner city. It's a totally different place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the time, you know, I look at photographs of the time. I mean, you know, the sunsets were
it was so
brown smog, right? And smoggy and everything. The air was terrible. And I didn't have any money. So if you have money, you can live out by the beach and you can,
right.
And you're in control of things. But I met a lot of people and I had a good time and, you know, sold. Yes, I was selling paintings. Yeah. In fact, I remember selling a painting to Graham Nash at a recording session. He said, come on, you know, bring some stuff down. I remember bringing some paintings down and there were some watercolors of models that I had done at the Art Institute, and he said, I love that. Let me buy that.
Did you know what to charge? Did you have a clue?
Yeah, you know what happened? I said, I didn't have a clue.
Yeah, I would think you probably wouldn't, right? Yeah.
So I said, okay. He said, how much do you want for it? And I said, well, my rent is $90 a month, and my phone bill is $10 a month. How about $100? And he said, would you take 150?
Wow.
And I said, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what a nice suggestion.
What a
that
great
was.
Guy. I know. He was a great guy then. He's a great guy now.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that later on, he started Nash Editions doing these, you know, Iris prints, Giclée prints. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the very first people who started doing work with him. And we did a ton of prints with him and a ton of business.
And so you'd do a print, you would do a painting, they'd make a print or Giclée of it.
We'd make a Giclée, we'd make a reproduction of a print, and the quality was so unbelievably good.
What kind of imagery?
Oh, mostly Western, mostly cowboys.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and they were so good. I mean, they were reproducing watercolors, and you can't reproduce a watercolor more perfectly than ink, water-based pigment on watercolor paper. I mean, if you couldn't see the edge of the print,
you couldn't tell
it wasn't the original.
And when were you doing this with Graham Nash?
This was much later.
Yeah, but when was that?
Oh, that was starting 90s? That was starting around 1990, mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3. They weren't calling them Giclées. They were calling them, because he was the only guy doing it.
Mm.
He was the guy who had modified an Iris printer, an inkjet printer, and started running watercolor paper through it. And so for the very first time, he was using it as a high-quality art reproduction
process. Yeah, and that was pretty revolutionary, actually.
It was completely revolutionary. He's a very smart, think outside of the box, inventive guy, and he really invented that technology, really to reproduce photographs, because he was also a photographer, mm-hmm. and had a great collection of vintage.
And is that business still around?
It is. Nash Editions is still around, and we still use them.
Hmm.
I know.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is cool. So that little $150, that gift that Graham gave me over that painting. Uh-huh.
Still pays for your rent.
Still, well, yeah.
A little water bill, maybe.
I've paid him back.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, no, he
many made, times.
Yeah, and so when you, so at some point there in L.A. in like 73.
Oh, and by the way,
yeah?
The night that I sold him that painting, he was recording his first album, and at one point he said, "So if anybody in the control room wants to come out and sing on this, come on ahead." So I said, okay. So I went out and sang on the chorus with Dave Mason and with Rita Coolidge and a bunch of people. You know, there were like 8 of us, but it was an amazing little group.
And what was the song?
The song is called Be Yourself, and it's still available. Oh, and you can still, you know, hear the little chorus.
Uh-huh. It has to give you great joy when you hear it play.
It's fun, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was in that movie with George Clooney. George Clooney and some girl up in, it took place on a plains, and there's, they used Be Yourself.
Oh,
as
yeah,
the
I know
fade
which one.
Out.
Yeah. Yeah, where he's the he goes around and
he's a salesman, I think.
Yeah, he cans people's jobs, I think is what he does. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
Right. It was a great movie, actually. Sorry, George, we don't remember the name of the movie, but it was very good.
It's good.
And so, but that's pretty amazing stuff that you're seeing at that time frame, but yet you still leave L.A.
Hated living in L.A.
You just couldn't take living.
You know,
there.
It, what's interesting is that I've always had a lot of confidence in my ability to make something happen. And I never, and I always liked the challenge. I liked being able to start over. I mean, there was one time in L.A., I remember when I was sitting in my little kitchen in my apartment above the garage, and I had 10 cents literally to my name. And I went out and bought a head of iceberg lettuce that cost 10 cents. And I had a little bit of salad dressing in the fridge. And I remember sitting there that day in my kitchen thinking, and I had a check coming from Capital. Capital owed me some money, and I was probably going to get it the next day. But I remember thinking, I'll never be necessarily poorer than this, but I'm going to do fine. I'm going to make money, and I'm going to have a successful career. And I remember sitting there with a smile on my face, enjoying that moment. Eating that head of lettuce.
Well, maybe you recognized that was kind of the low ebb of where you were, and you could see your path forward.
Yeah, absolutely. But I always felt, you know, I can walk away from this and still make it happen. I don't need to necessarily build on
the album covers. And yeah. So, how long after that did you leave and go to?
So then a friend of mine had a great place out in Topanga Canyon, and he was a photographer, and he was doing, you know, a lot of the Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Neil Young stuff. And but at that point had bought a 56 Chevy pickup truck, and he let me build a wooden camper on the back of that pickup truck. And I would come out on the weekends and work on it. And I'd never built anything before, but, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of figured out how to screw everything together and built this really cool wooden camper. And it became my ark. I named it Sally Ann. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was redwood and I varnished it and it had, you know, bubbles and it had stained glass window in the back and it had a little, a fishing stove in it and had a closet and sink and, you know, and a bed. And it was really beautiful. And that became my escape vehicle.
And you could go and use it and stay in it?
Yeah. I mean, I could live. I mean, and once it was done, I could live in it.
Yes.
And I did.
Saved $100 a month.
Traveled, yeah. You know, so then I started traveling.
And what was it named? Sally what?
Sally Ann.
Sally Ann. Do you know where that vehicle is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, okay.
We've kept it through all of these years up in different places, and we've renovated it, and it is now in its final resting place in the corner of our property in Denver. And it's hidden by trees out in the middle of the woods, in the middle of, and so to go there now, you have to go back out across the lawn and into the back garden, duck under trees, and go through a special walkway. And there it is, like a little hobbit house with an arched top and a chimney and everything. And you go in, and it's like going into a time machine.
Yeah, especially for you.
Well, not just for me. Everybody I take out there, I mean, you know, and I've taken many people out there, and, you know, for a glass of wine or for a smoke or something. And everybody starts reminiscing about their early days.
Yeah.
Everybody. It is just wild.
Yeah, I'm going to go and see Sally Ann just so you
come
know.
On out and Sally Ann.
And so you start traveling the West.
So
with
I started
that?
Traveling thinking, you know, I'm going to move, but I have no idea where I'm going to land. And I ended up came through Santa Fe, and I came through, you know, Taos, and I thought, you know, this is a place I know I'm going to come back to.
This was like 72 or 72?
72.
Yeah, okay.
And I had friends in Denver, and we're all living in a house together, and they were really good friends who I'd known in San Francisco. And so they invited me to come and stay, and I stayed, and it was so great. And then I met more friends up in Steamboat Springs, and I ended up going up there and loving that. But I'd always wanted to live in a teepee, so I came back to Denver, where I'd already gotten a studio and had kind of put down semi-roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that teepee book that we all know that we all had in the 60s, 70s, and figured out a pattern. And I sewed up a teepee out of canvas and took it up to Steamboat Springs and found a great place to set it up, cut down lodgepole pine from the ski runs that they were just cutting out up on the mountain, mm-hmm. Steamboat. And I ended up staying in Steamboat for about 6 months.
In your teepee?
In my teepee, yeah, along the river, along Elk River Road.
And how old were you then, like 25?
No. I was 22 or 3.
Oh, yeah.
23, I think. I think I just turned 23. And I would paint. So I was really fried from living in Hollywood. And so I would go out every day and paint and do landscapes where I was in Steamboat, and figured out a way to cut mats. And every Saturday morning, I'd pull Sally Ann up in front of FM Lights, which was the Western wear store, mm-hmm. in Steamboat. Steamboat's mm-hmm. was a pretty tiny little town at that point. And I'd put up my paintings, and I hung out a sign that said paintings for sale, mm-hmm. which I still have.
The sign? Oh,
sign,
that's cool.
Yeah. And I would put up, you know, five or six paintings, and every Saturday morning I'd sell two or three paintings.
Uh-huh.
And so that was enough to kind of...
live.
Yeah, it was enough to buy groceries and come back to the teepee.
Uh-huh. And those were all landscapes? No cowboy?
They were all landscapes.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, there may have been some horses and cattle, but in general they were landscapes. And there were some good paintings. I mean, I've seen a few of them since then. They were bought by local people,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a lot of people still have them up there. I've probably sold, I don't know, 60 paintings over there.
Do you remember what you were selling for at that time?
Yeah.
What was it?
$100
Yeah, that's okay.
$50 Yeah. $60
Yeah.
You know, money was very different, as you know.
Yeah, and you're living in a teepee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when
cut
the,
no expenses.
And so when the winter started to come, which comes harsh.
The winter came. I was also living with a lovely young lady. And so when the winter started getting cold, we decided to move back to Denver.
Yeah.
Which we did. And then got a place in Denver, which turns out is actually 3 blocks from where I live right now.
And that's funny.
That Laura and I live. I know.
And so did you, at that point, you probably thought you were a painter, I would assume, because you're making money as a painter. You've been doing it for a few years with your album covers. Then you get the Larimer Square thing. That's in 73. So the next
but
year.
I was still doing album covers. You know, I was still doing things for people. You know, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
And would they contact you from L.A.?
They would. No, yeah, and you know, I had made a lot of friends, so I was doing, and I had driven around. I ended up doing Dickie Betz's first album cover with the Allman Brothers. I'd been out to Macon, Georgia, and introduced myself to. You know, I drove. I was always interested in Southern and blues and R&B. So I'd been out to Memphis and met Willie Mitchell and a bunch of Stax Fault guys. And then I went over to Macon and met Phil, the guy who owned and ran Capricorn Records.
I don't know.
And he was great. And he, you know, he had the Allman Brothers and Marshall
Tucker
Band.
Wasn't Phil Spector, though, right?
Wasn't Phil Spector. No, it was Phil, shit.
And how do you meet these guys? Just because you have the ability to say, I'm a painter, and or did you just knock on the door and say?
You just knock on the door.
Yeah.
You just, you know, you might call or you might just knock on the door and say, you know, can I show you my work?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got to be ballsy. I mean, you know, that was kind of the first lesson is if you don't knock on the door, you're never going to meet them. The worst they can say is, you know, piss
away,
off.
Kid. Yeah.
But I kind of early on, I was ballsy.
Yeah, you have
and
to
I,
be.
And
yeah.
you have to be.
Yeah.
And you
no,
have
it's
true. To, you know, you have to take a shot. And so I would do that. And a lot of times, I mean, I never got anything from Willie Mitchell, but we had a great time.
Yeah.
And we really had fun hanging out in his office and, you know, doing stuff.
So you kept doing the album covers.
So I kept doing
for
some album
period
covers.
Of time. And when did you?
But I was also started doing other things like, you know, I got more serious about graphic design. So I ended up doing, you know, working for local people in Denver, you know, Celestial Seasonings. Mm. The tea company was just starting out. So I went up there and Mo Siegel and I became great friends. So I ended up working on, you know, all of that early packaging. And Mountain High Ice Cream and Yogurt was up there. So I started doing all of that.
Yeah, right time, right place.
And, well, you know, that those were little tiny startup businesses, but they needed something. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know anything about packaging, but I know what I'd like to see. So so I started doing a lot of that. And I started designing kind of whatever I could get my hands on, whether it was books or annual reports or, you know, businessy things.
Mm-hmm.
And but then in 1975 or in 1974, again, I was bored. I mean, my parents were sort of watching this. You know, when I moved out of L.A., my dad went, you know, what are you thinking? I mean, you've got this business going now, and now you're going to walk away from it?
Yeah, I bet.
And I said, yeah, I know, but I'm just kind of bored with it. And then, you know, in Denver, I'd set up this design studio. I'd done a show and I had, you know, I had projects and I'd done a lot of projects, but I was bored and I wanted to do more. So in 1974, I packed everything up. In January of 1975, I left for Europe and moved over to Europe turning into 5 years.
Oh, wow. I'm where in Europe?
So,
everywhere.
Oh, God. Well, I landed in London. I had a friend's parents were there, and they welcomed me in. And then I kind of took off, and I you know, just started hitchhiking around. I met a girl and you know, in France and traveled with her for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, went all through Italy and Greece, spent, you know, several months in Greece.
And you do this for 5 years?
I did this for 5 years.
Wow. Did you not have to get a visa or a...
No, and it was, in those days, it was a lot easier, and I could kind of live, and I left America with less than $1,000 in my pocket.
Yeah.
I had nothing. I remember Mo saying... Well, do you want me to give you stock in Celestial Seasonings? And I said, no, I want you to give me the $200 you owe me.
That one haunts you.
Yeah.
And did you bring your paints when you went over or bought paints while
I
you were
did.
There? Yeah, you brought them.
I brought paints and I brought a banjo.
Yeah.
And
that's all you need.
Well, that was all I needed. I certainly didn't have anything else. I had one extra pair of shoes pair of pants and an extra shirt and, you know, some underwear and a pair of socks. And I mean, you know, I had almost nothing but this. I mean, this is a sort of long, convoluted, you know, circuitous story.
Yeah, but it forms you. I mean, 5 years in Europe.
It formed me a lot.
It changes the way you see the world.
I know. It formed me a lot. And a lot of it was following my nose wherever it seemed interesting.